brings rewards and sin brings punishment. We'll see that pop up here in a minute. But God wants the people to repent. And the prophets, that's the general theme of all of them is, I'm going to chastise you for what you've done, but I want you back. Okay? I want repentance. And there's coming a day of reckoning. It's referred to the prophets a lot of times that the day of Jehovah is coming. It can be against individuals or against nations, either one. But there's going to be a time when God's going to pronounce judgment. And it'll be deliverance for the righteous, it'll be punishment for those who are evil. That day is coming. But what he wants is righteousness out of all the nations. So he calls on all of them to measure up to what he wants, to his standard. He's again going to chastise those who don't. He's going to reward those who do. That's just the repetitive theme throughout the prophets there. So we see this thing we talked about in this class already. Obedience, blessings, sin, punishment. And we see that, we've seen that already, and we'll talk about it even more this morning. Also in most all the prophets, you'll see this messianic theme. Christ is in there somewhere, and the Messiah is coming down the way. We saw it right at the end of the book of Obadiah last time. So, that message is coming, that Christ is coming. He's coming to save those who are faithful. He's coming to destroy those who aren't, which is the same thing you see through the prophets there. And then, a whole new world order of spirituality is coming. And that, of course, would be Christ's kingdom as opposed to the law of Moses. The Messiah's going to come in. He's going to set up his kingdom. It's referred to different ways in the prophets, the mountain of the Lord's house, a kingdom, different references to it. But it's all talking about Christ coming to establish the church and his kingdom as opposed to that of the law of Moses. So that's a kind of brief summary of what the prophets in general are about, and that is, repentance, come back to me, I want you back. If you don't, I'll chastise you. If you do, I'll reward you. Which is the same thing that we threw out. And that's in the Old Testament times, and then the prophetic time of Messiah coming that ties in with that. Alright, let's get back to the narrative and kind of where we are now with our storyline. Jehoshaphat, good king in Judah, reigned 25 years. Followed his father, Asa, 41 years of good reign. So Judah has had a good king there for 66 years. Little checkbox on the thing up there, if that could be written on our tombstone, that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. I mean, nothing greater than you have said about us, but that's it. That's what's said about Jehoshaphat. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. But high places weren't destroyed. The people didn't turn their hearts back to God. And that makes it very easy to turn back to what's coming next. If you don't have the hearts of the people turned around, that's where it comes scary. And I put the circle on there to remind me to make a couple of comments this morning. There have been people, I'm bringing it down to us at Eastside right now. The people sit here at Eastside that have heard teaching and preaching over and over and over and over and over. And one gentleman I'm thinking about in particular attended here, his wife died. He married another lady, different religious background, and he was gone. And like all the preaching that he'd heard all this time, didn't mean anything. And so I think about that in relation to me. I mean, all the teaching I've heard, how easy is it going to be for someone to pull me away? I think about my children. I think about my grandchildren. I think about the sheep that I'm somewhat responsible for in this congregation. How many are sitting here of us are sitting here hearing teaching over and over and over? The good influence of Asa and Jehoshaphat for all these years. And yet the people weren't touched. They weren't touched in their hearts. And then this king comes along and wants to pull it back the other direction. And what? They're gone. just that easy. And that's it's a scary, it's a frightening thing we have to really work and guard against. Okay, right at the end of Jehoshaphat's life, there's a little three or four verses here that talks about the relationship he had with Ahaziah. Now, Ahaziah's already died in our narrative, so I think it's kind of stuck in the end of Jehoshaphat's life. But basically, the two of them got together. We know Jehoshaphat had a relationship with Ahab, and of course, Ahaziah was his son. But they got together and they'll make some ships and go up against Tarsus. And God didn't like that idea, didn't like what they were doing. He destroyed the ships. That's kind of the end of that story. Just two or three verses touched on there, right at the end of Jehoshaphat's life. But Jehoshaphat dies now, and 66 years of good kings are gone. Jehoram, his son, is now reigning in his place. So now we've got a Jehoram reigning in Judah and a Jehoram reigning in Israel. Ahab and Jezebel's son, Ahaziah, reigned first. He died out after 2 years and had no children, so his brother Jehoram took it. So we got Jehoram in Israel and Jehoram in Judah, both. So, Jehoram and Judah. This is all review from last time now. As six brothers, he came to the throne, he got things kind of established, and he went in and killed all his brothers. Wiped them out. I don't have fear of them coming in and taking over the throne from him. That's what you have to assume. But he took, killed all his brothers, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He did not follow in the steps of his grandfather and his father, yet he turned the people away from God. He was influenced by the lady he married. And that was Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And they turned him hearts away. God would have destroyed them. They did not because of the sake of David. And the promise he had made to David in 2 Samuel 7. When he said to David that he, your son, Solomon, will build a house for my name. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And that thread is going to keep running. And because of that, with no brothers left to take the throne, God did not destroy Jehoram even because of his wickedness. Not uncommon we see for nations to rebel against the king when a new king comes in. It seems like that may be what happened here. But Edom and this little city, Libna, rebelled against Jehoram. In 2 Chronicles 21:11 says that he, that is Jehoram, made high places in the mountains of Judah, caused the inhabitants of Israel to commit harlotry. They were supposed to be married to God, to Jehovah, and they were not. They were worshiping all the idols and the things that Jehoram had set up. He brought in from his relationship with Ahab and Jezebel and their daughter. This warning letter comes in from Elijah. We talked about that some. And then this battle between the Philistines and the Arabians coming in and attacking them. All of the sons of Jehoram are killed now, but one little child. So his brothers are gone and all of his sons are gone. So this thread is hanging very, very thin that God has promised to maintain and through the lineage of David here. So we'll kind of leave that hanging for a minute. We jump off now and look at the book of Obadiah. It seems to fit in this time frame here. Obadiah is a prophecy concerning Edom, and it's a parallel between Jacob and Esau and their life, and Judah and Edom and the nations that followed from them. It's a time when strangers came in and carried the fortress away. Foreigners came into the city of Jerusalem. Lots of times that happened. We looked at a bunch of those. It seems that those, one of them fits in here, this time frame with Jehoram. And that's why we put the book at this spot here. So, differences on the time of the book. If it does fit in this time frame, as opposed to when Nebuchadnezzar came in and took the city of Jerusalem later on, then this would be the first of the written prophets. And of course, it's about Edom there. Edom had been conquered by David back earlier on, but now God is going to use them to punish Jehoram. Why? Jehoram, sin brings punishment. Jehoram left God, taken the nation away from God, turned their hearts back to evil, and God's going to use them. But the book of Obadiah is about Edom, your turn's coming too. God's going to punish you. You don't get away with it. You're evil, and God's going to punish you as well. So, judgment's coming on Edom, verse 1. Nations will rise up against them. Pride was their big thing. I mean, we showed the picture last time of the clefts and the mountains and the homes built in the side of the mountains up there. No one could bring me down. They had too much pride. But God said, I will bring you down. I can and I will bring you down. So then, verse 5-9, everything's going to be destroyed. Edom's going to essentially be wiped out at some point. They're noted for their wise men. We pointed out that Eliphaz, one of the men that comes in, friends of Job, was a wise man, and he was one of the cities in Edom. Why is the destruction coming on? Because of the way they had treated Jacob, the sons of Jacob, that is, Judah, and the way they had taken it when Jerusalem was attacked and destroyed. What's going to happen to them? So as you've done, so it's going to be done to you. What you sow is what you're going to reap. And the verse we looked at, it applies to us. We're going to all stand in that judgment time, and we're going to give account of what we've done. As you've done, so it's going to be done to you. But what we're doing now is how we're what we're going to reap when that judgment time's coming. This is a judgment against the nation of Edom. The same principle applies to us individually. The last part of them was messianic, where Edom is used generally as a symbol of unrepentant mankind in general. And it talks about then the deliverance coming from outside. So that's just a quick run through back through the book of Obadiah. All right. We got this little bit at the end of 2 Chronicles 21, and then mainly we talk about 2 Kings 4 this morning. So a little bit that's left over here is back to Jehoram. God smote him with this disease in his bowels, and he suffered, and the key word there, he did suffer, apparently greatly, for 2 years. He even says his bowels came out, very gross type thing. He died, he was buried in the city of David, but this note, he was not in the tombs of the kings. The people did not put him, when he died, into that place of honor, the tombs of the kings. They did bury him, and I'd like this to be written on your tombstone. He departed without being desired. In other words, no one cared that he had died. In fact, the good people felt relief that he was gone. So, that's something to think about. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Now, over in Israel, we had Ahab reigning, and then his son Ahaziah reigned. He died, and his son Jehoram took it. So it was Ahaziah and then Jehoram. Now, over in Judah, we're going to write the opposite. We have Jehoram's been reigning. He now dies, and his son Ahaziah takes over. So we've got a flip-flop in the order for us to come here. So Jehoram dies, and his son Ahaziah is going to take his place. We're going to leave the narrative there. We're going to go to 2 Kings chapter 4 now, and we're going to look at Elisha for a while. What we got this morning is some stories about Elisha. Of course, Elisha comes on the scene when Elijah is taken up in the whirlwind into heaven. Somewhere timing-wise, about the time between the Ahaziah and Jehoram over in Israel. You don't think about the kings and where Elisha and Elijah, that transformation took place there. And make this note, that we got several stories in this chapter here. And there's no reason to think they're all exactly, this one happened the next day, this one happened the next day. This, I mean, it's not like they're chronological, one after the other, after the other, after the other. You go in the time of Christ, and sometime it'll say, and the next day this happened, or and the next day this happened. We don't have that here. It's just simply a collection of stories about Elisha that happened in the exact order and the time it, we don't have. It doesn't name a king. This goes on and talks about Elisha and his story. Now, the first one here is Elisha and the widow's oil. So the wife of one of the sons of the prophets, and we talked about that term before, the sons of the prophets, comes to him and says, I need help. I'm in trouble. Creditors are coming in, and they want to take my sons as slaves for the debt that I owe them. And so Elisha says, well, what do you have? What do you have in your house? And she says, I have nothing except a little jar of oil. So he tells her to go out and borrow vessels. Borrow vessels and the little phrases in there, he said, and not too few. Go get a bunch of them. Go get all these vessels that you can find that will hold oil. And go in and shut your door, you and your sons, and you start pouring this oil out. You pour oil out of this jar you have into these vessels. And she does that. And she fills up vessels and vessels and vessels and that. She turned to sell her sons and said, I need the next vessel. And he says, there are no more. They're all full. And when that happened, the jar quit giving oil. And the miraculous flow of oil from there had stopped then. So she goes back and tells Elisha what she's done. He says, take the oil, go sell it, pay your debtors, pay those who you owe, and take the rest of the oil, the money you get from it, and you and your sons live off that money. And so that's what she does. Live off the proceeds then. That's a little story. It's just a miraculous story of events in the life of Elisha here. The next one occurs in the town of Shunem. Now, here it is on the map right here. Gotta get where we are. This is the Jezreel Valley. Runs northwest to southeast. Sea of Galilee, be right over here. Mount Carmel, be right up here. We're in the northern part of Israel. Here is Endor, where Saul went to see the witch of Endor. Remember that? And here's Mount Gilboa, where Saul and his sons were killed in the battle with the Philistines. Ended their lives here. There's Shunem up here in the middle of that little valley. Here. So we're in the very northern part. There's a well-to-do woman there, still there with her husband. And Elisha would come through there at various times, and she would invite him in to eat. And so this seems that it's occurred several times. And finally she says, she recognizes he's a man of God, something special about him. And so she tossed her husband and said, let's make a little room on the roof for him. Let's put up some walls and put a bed and a table and a chair and a lampstand there and just have a little place where Elisha can stay when he's passing through. So her husband agrees to do this. And so they fix this room. So one time that Elisha and his servant Gehazi were there and they've been very nice to them and provide this room for them. And so he tells Gehazi, I said, call the Shunammite woman in. And what he wants to know, you've done all this good stuff for us. What can we do for you? Can I go speak to the king? Can I speak to the commander of the army? Can I talk to someone on your behalf and do something good for you? And she basically says, no, I'm okay. Everything's fine like it is. I don't really need anything special. Gehazi recognized the fact that her husband was old, and she had no sons. So he said, well, call her in. So he calls her back in and tells her, this time next year, you'll have a son. And she says, no, my Lord, don't lie to me. Doubt, very much like Sarah did at that time because of the age of her husband. So she has a son. Some time passes. We don't know how much. How old the boy is, but he goes out to the field with his father where they have the servants out there with the crops or something, and he complains with his head. My head, his head is hurting. And the father says, tells the servants, take him to his mother and let her look after him. So she holds him in her arms until noon, and he dies. So she takes the boy up and places him in Elisha's bed, and she tells the servant, mount, prepare me a donkey, and don't slow down. We're going to Mount Carmel, where Elisha is, and go get him. Drive, go. Don't stop in a hurry. So Elisha sees her coming, so he sends Gehazi, his servant, out to meet her. He said, the Shunammite woman's coming. Go out and meet her. Find what's wrong. Go out and say, is it all well with you? Is it all well with your husband? Is it all well with your son? Or how are you? What's going on? And so she wouldn't even stop and talk to Gehazi. She went right on by. Goes up to Elisha and falls down at his feet, grabs his feet. Gehazi's going to come in and kind of push her off because he knows what's going on exactly. And Elisha says, no, let her alone. So something is distressing her greatly, and I don't know what it is, because God hadn't told me about it. God has not revealed to me what's going on in this case. So she tells him what's happened. So he sends Gehazi ahead to take my staff and lay it on the boy's face. So he does. He goes ahead. She would not leave Elisha. Gehazi meets him coming back and says, no breath is in him. It did not do any good when I laid your staff on the boy's face here. Nothing happened. So they go on. Elisha goes into the room where the boy is, and he prays, and he stretches his body out on the boy. His hands are on his hands, his face is on his face, and it lays down on the body. And some warmth is there. But he gets up, he walks around the room, and he goes back the second time, stretches himself out again on the boy, and this time, the boy sneezes and comes back to life. And so he tells Gehazi, call the mom in. And he does. Take your son. But first she goes and falls down at his feet. Gratitude like we can imagine only. And thanks him for what he has done. And she takes her son and goes out then. And that's kind of the end of that story. Again, just a miraculous event in the time of Elisha here. There's another one here, and there's just one after the other in this chapter here. So there's a whole series of events in Elisha's life. This one occurs at Gilgal. Now, whoops, back up. Wrong button. Gilgal. Here's Jericho. Here's the Dead Sea. We're down in the southern part. We were up here. Now we're down in the southern part now. Here's Jerusalem here. Top end of the Dead Sea. Gilgal is here. The question mark about it is that the Gilgal is talked about here? I think it could be, because if you look back, we've already talked about when Elijah was taken up from Elisha. Remember they went to Bethel? Came down to Jericho, down and went across the Jordan River, and that's where Elijah was taken up. He came back up to Jericho and met with the sons of the prophets there. So Elijah and Elisha have already been here to these places. So it's not like a place he would not have been. So think about Gilgal being down in the southern part, just above the Dead Sea, is where this event seems to have taken place. Famine in the land, and there's a group of the sons of the prophets there with Elisha. And he tells them, put on a pot of stew. We got something to eat here. So put on a pot of stew. Let's feed the people. And one man goes out and he finds a vine, it says, and he was gathering these gourds off this vine. And he brings them back and he slices them up and puts them in the stew. He did not know that they were very bitter and they were poisonous. So when they start eat the stew, they yell out, there's death in the pot, there's death in the pot. There was something there that was not only bitter, it tasted bad, but it was poisonous. So Elisha gets some, like one person says some meal, the other has some flour, brings that and sells them, put it in the pot. And what he does, puts that in there, they dip it out and they eat it. The bitterness is gone and there's nothing harmful in this stew anymore. So Elisha has made it okay to eat, but his putting the meal in there, which of course had nothing to do with it except the miraculous part that was involved in it. And even if this goes with this or the first part of the next lesson, I'm worried I'm headed it. But some man comes and brings some loaves to him there. Now, that must be the next lesson. I've got a slide about that. So okay. That's kind of it for the narrative part. Thanks. I don't normally have a problem with it, so like I am this morning. All right. Comments on the narratives, any of it, anybody? We have about 10 minutes left here. I got just two or three things to talk about. Mike, go ahead. I got plenty of time. That way back when, yeah. Yeah, okay. Significant places to go indeed, yeah. Maybe one of the sons of the prophets gathered around there. It was a significant place. What Mike's saying is that the altars were set up at Gilgal where they brought the stones out of the Jordan to be a key spot for them to be in worship and gather around and have a gathering place for them. There, maybe why he would go back down to Gilgal to see them. Okay, good point. All right, let's go back and think about this point on the slide up here. And think about the influence of Athaliah that she apparently had on Jehoram. Jehoram had had the influence of grandfather and father as good kings, and those around him. But Ahab and his relationship with and Jehoshaphat, his father, relationship with Ahab, and marriage now to Athaliah, and the influence she had has taken and turned the nation now away from good to evil where God is punishing them. So think about influence a minute. Two questions. Who's going to influence me? Who's going to influence me? Preacher? One of the elders? You? Some boss at work? My wife? Who has influence on your life? And the second question then is who are you going to influence? You have influence over a spouse? Over your children? Over other people here sitting in the congregation? Who do you influence? Of course, is that influence good or bad? Which one we choose is, of course, up to us. But there are people we are going to influence other people and other people who influence us. Whether we like it or not, that's the way it is. There's a piece in the bulletin today that reads, "A careful man I ought to be, a little fellow follows me. I do not dare go astray, for fear he'll go the self-same way." We all think about that and take it to heart. There are people watching us, people watching you, people watching me, and what I do and the influence I'll have on them can be long-lasting. Again, through that influence, to the spreading of that influence, as it did here with Athaliah influencing Jehoram, and then spread out to the kingdom, that influence of what I do to somebody else can go a long ways in the wrong direction. So think about our influence. The second point I'll talk about for a minute is this thing about Jehoram dying. They didn't bury him in the tombs of the kings. And the thing he said about him was, he departed without being desired. No one cared. The good people were rejoiced. They were glad to see him gone. So the question is, who's going to mourn when I die? He said, oh, my family will. Of course. Well, yeah. We've all heard funeral talks about the dash between the numbers, 1945 dash, whatever. What's that dash? What happens between the numbers? So, how are people going to feel when I die? You ever think about that? If they get past the initial, what's God going to say when I die? That's the key thing. It really matters. 8:25 gives us two choices. Either God's going to say, come, blessed my Father, or he's going to say, what? Depart. God's going to say, come with me or go away from me, one or the other. And I don't read that chapter anywhere else. There's another choice. So how am I going to live my life? What are people going to say when I die? Are you going to care? What's God going to say when I die? No? Get away from me. And the third one is exactly the good people felt this relief because his evil influence was gone. The good people in Judah were glad Jehoram has died and his evil influence was gone. My question here is, will good people be glad when I'm gone? What can I do with my influence so that godly people will really care and say, we're going to miss him, or we're going to miss her, we're going to miss what that person's done? What do I need to do to have that kind of influence that good people are going to be glad he's gone, or good people will be glad he's not gone? Back in Genesis chapter 50, when Jacob had died, remember they've come down now, his father Jacob dies in Genesis chapter 50. And it's interesting in verse 3, 40 days are required for him as he's getting the embalming done and the stuff. And it says, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourn for him 70 days. The Egyptians mourn for Jacob 70 days. If it's read that the Egyptians mourn for Joseph for 70 days, it'd be understandable maybe, because Joseph had actually saved her all their lives with what he had done with storing up the grain. This is Jacob. He had not been there all that long. But they mourn for him. And then look what else happened. When the days of the mourning passed, Joseph spake to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of the Pharaoh, and saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. And therefore, please go back and bury my father, and I will come back. Pharaoh said, go and bury your father, as he made you swear. So they went back to Canaan to bury Jacob. So Joseph went to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, with all the house of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house, only the little ones and flocks and herds left in Goshen. They went up with him, both chariots and horsemen, a very great gathering. They came to flesh and four of Atad, which is beyond Jordan. They mourned there with very great and very solemn lamentation. Observed 7 days of mourning for his father. The inhabitants of the land of Canaan saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad and said, this is some grievous mourning of the Egyptians. And my whole point here is, look at the reaction when Jacob died. Look at the reaction when Jacob died. And I won't live to the point where there'll be an entourage of some other nation take off from my burial. I don't understand that. I don't care. But will people care because a good person has died? Oh, sure it was. I mean, no doubt about it. No doubt about that. But still, they cared enough about the good life there to do that. And same with Aaron. Aaron, they mourned for Aaron 30 days. Okay? The whole point I'm getting to is, am I living my life in a way that Jehoram says, we're glad he's gone. His evil influence is out of here. Or am I living such, and good people are going to say, we're glad he's gone. I live in such that people will mourn when I die and care. Talk about character. and my influence. Okay, comments on any of this stuff? Anybody? Okay, I think that's, yep. Nope, I got one more. This little thing I found across this week kind of ties into it. Those of you who do text messaging, if you died today and the last text you received was what's on your tombstone, what would it say? And it's what the general idea there is. And the text testing I'm doing, is it wholesomeness of what I'll be going on or as opposed to something that should not be going on? So. Okay, that's it. Thank you.